So we're in Pentateuch. We're picking up in chapter 33 of Numbers. Actually, I briefly, I started the chapter yesterday, and we went through verse 4, and I wanted to spend a little more time there because it talks about the timing of them going out, keeping the Passover, how they went out with a high hand. I still like that better than with boldness. That's the difference between the old King James and the new. But then, as I was just mentioning to Craig, my next notation in my notes is verse 5 through verse 49. It's a long listing of, okay, they camped here, then they moved on, and they camped there, and they moved on. We don't know how long they stayed at most of those points. But one thing I'll say is, actually, I was going to point at the map. I like to point at the map meaninglessly, although it's not meant to be meaninglessly. But what we see in most of chapter 33 is a group of about 2.5 to 3 million people wandering around in a relatively small area. You know, for that many people to be there for 40 years, it's not a big area, and they're going back and forth, and God is providing for them, feeding them manna every day, sending quail, it seems, every day. Sometimes I wonder, and this is my speculation, what did the Egyptians think happened to them? You know, of course, Egypt is in shambles when they leave, but they're gradually going to be picking things up. I wonder if 20 years later they're saying, whatever happened to those Israelites? You know, haven't heard anything of them. They just wandered off and disappeared. Apparently, stories did get around. Remember when the scouts that go to Jericho, they meet Rahab and say, oh, we've heard about how the Lord parted the Red Sea and you went through. So their reputation seems to have got around, but did people know they were out there in the wilderness? I'm asking this without being able to answer the question. Some people speculate that, you know, perhaps some merchants came, you know, passing through. You have nomads and Bedouins might have came and did trade with them at times. And again, that's pure speculation. But so we pass this time, and God basically has them in a holding action. Why? Because they refused to enter the promised land when he originally intended. Actually, we'll review that very soon as we start the book of Deuteronomy. I want to move ahead and point something out in verse 38. There's a reminder of Aaron, the high priest's death, which we just went over in chapter 20. It was back in Numbers 20, verses 23 through 29. But here in chapter 33, verse 38, it says, then Aaron the high priest went up to Mount Hor at the command of the Eternal and died there. In the 40th year after the children of Israel had left the land of Egypt, Aaron was 123 years old. So we know for certain that Aaron died near the very end of the children of Israel's wandering. Moses would end his life at 120 years old, and Aaron was 3 years older than him. We believe that their sister Miriam's death came not that long before Aaron's. And I say we believe, or I believe, but the scripture isn't absolutely clear that it wasn't considerably earlier. But the way events are described, it seemed like her death wasn't that long before his. I'll move ahead to verse 50 of chapter 33. You'll notice it's a long chapter, but we're not spending a lot of detail, and I'm not going to try to pronounce all those names, although it can be fun. Verse 50, now the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you've crossed the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you'll drive out the inhabitants from the land before you, destroy all their engraved stones, destroy all their molded images, demolish their high places. God wanted them to not only remove the people, but get rid of their artwork, get rid of their religious symbols, cleanse the land of their culture, so to speak. In modern times, how would we react to that, such things going on? When I say we, I mean our society. Well, actually, yeah, Kayla?
I think over in some of the Islamic nations, they're destroying a lot of the artifacts, we would say. We would say it's destroying cultural heritage.
Yeah, I was going to point out, yeah, that is happening and has happened, especially groups like ISIS and others that are extremist Muslims. They take the command to get rid of idols very literally, and they're destroying what some people are saying, oh, you're destroying these ancient artifacts that are worth millions. And so That's pretty much what God told the Israelites to do. I'm not saying we should interpret this to mean we in God's church today should storm the museums and destroy any idols we see. We saw some interesting ones when we went to the art museum, and I'm glad nobody pulled out a hammer, bashed in the case, and started smashing them. That it's not our place, but I think we could make the argument, it seems when God comes, when Jesus Christ establishes his throne, I don't know that he's going to have a museum full of those things. They'll probably be destroyed. But I want to make the point that God was doing that for Israel. He wanted them to start in a new land unpolluted with the prior culture. That's one reason he wanted all the people removed and all the signs of their false religion, wanted all that to be gone. Israel would end up not obeying. And we know specifically they didn't remove all the peoples. And if you don't remove all the people, you don't remove all of their religion and all of their cultural habits. And Israel would suffer the consequences. And God says some of the consequences. In verse 55, if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, it'll be that those whom you let remain will be irritants in your eyes and thorns in your sides. They're going to be like splinters in your eyes and in your skin. Anybody here had a splinter? Yeah, don't you hate those? Huh? You know, even the ones that aren't that bad, they just bug you. And, you know, you try to get it out and you... I'm one of the worst because I'll end up ripping a huge hunk of flesh out to get the little thing out. But still, it's better than that irritant there. God, I guess by the looks on your faces, God gave a good example. These things are bad. You know, you're going to leave them. It's going to cause you trouble. But they still did. Okay, so. Oh, yeah, in verse 56. Moreover, it shall be that I will do to you as I thought to do to them. God says, get them out of there because they'll ruin you, you know, and if you don't get rid of them, I'll get rid of you. And in a sense, God would do that. He would have a foreign nation come in and not annihilate all the Israelites, but remove them from the land. And of course, some of the Jewish people would be allowed to return to fulfill God's plan and his prophecies. Okay, so having said that, we move next to another item of business in chapter 34. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the children of Israel, say to them, when you come to the land of Canaan, the land that will fall to you as inheritance, the land of Canaan to its boundaries. So, in essence, you know, the land of Canaan is what you're going to get. Well, they might say, well, what is that? And I what I would do is say, chapter 34 is this. It basically describes, you know, roughly the borders. So, basically, from where here, down there, over there, and you know, and I'm not going to read through all of it, that some of the challenges we have with it is that we can see the general area on maps, and we have an idea. We believe they're mostly correct, but there's some things we don't know for sure. Like God mentions the boundary of Edom, as though I guess Moses knew where the boundary of Edom was at the time. We don't know exactly. We know it was in this area. One of them has Edom marked on it. Yeah, here's Edom. And of course, we've got a neat line between the yellow and the purple, but that's an estimate. Oh, it also goes on to mention the brook of Egypt or river of Egypt in verse 5. I'm glad it says brook as opposed to the old King James saying river, because your first instinct is if it's the river of Egypt, it's this big one, the Nile. No, that's not what it meant. It seems to have referred to some stream or wadi somewhere around here. And there's some people would place it closer to here, some closer to the other side of the Sinai Peninsula. One, a name that often people attach to it is the Wadi El Arish. And I know the name, but I don't think I could point on a map and say this is exactly where it is. But it was a well-known body of water, or more like a gully, it seems, that was considered Egypt's eastern boundary, and it would make Israel's western. It mentions a Mount Hor in verse 7. Of course, it mentions where it says the Great Sea is your western border. That one's pretty easy. We do know where that was, the Mediterranean Sea, so they'd get over to there then. That's their border there, going up, and apparently there was a Mount Hor somewhere up here, not the same one where Aaron died. We just read a little bit ago that Aaron, when his time was up, God said, you're going to go up there. That was a different mount with the same name. And I enjoy the Hebrew for that, Hor HaHor. Literally, the mountain of the mountain is what I've read is how it's interpreted. The mountain or of the mountains. Some say that that's referring to a double peak somewhere in the Lebanon mountain range. So it's evident probably Moses and later Joshua would figure it out. It's not one that we have to know. It mentions at the end of verse 11, the Sea of Kinnereth. Here, as Sea of Kinnereth. Also, we call it the Sea of Galilee. So it's that little body of water there. The Salt Sea, or the Dead Sea, as we call it. And verses 13 through 15 here of chapter 34 mentions specifically, okay, you're going to divide this area up by lot and give it to the 9.5 tribes who haven't been assigned land yet. So when he's describing the borders, he stays, matter of fact, he lists the River Jordan as being the border, not because this isn't now part of the promised land, but because it's already been assigned. So the Transjordan, Galilee and Bashan, is going to go to Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh. So there's 9.5 tribes left to divide up this area. And this probably shouldn't be surprising at all. You've been through the book of Joshua where they actually drew lots and started assigning land. Verses 16 through 29 lists princes from each of the tribes who would get together to do this when the time comes. And I'm not going to go through and try to pronounce their names, but they'll work with Eleazar and Joshua to divide the land. I do remember Caleb is one of them. So he's one of two who were of that generation allowed to survive and enter the promised land. Joshua is in Moses' old job, or will be at that time, so he doesn't get to represent one of the tribes, but Caleb does. It doesn't say that God is naming these leaders in any particular sequential order. At least it's not in an order that we've seen before. But curiously, if I remember correctly, if you go to Joshua and list them out, they're listed here in the same order that the tribes will be given their land when they draw lots. And it falls, the way they would be assigned is somewhat with a familiar relationship. You know, the brothers with the same mothers would be closer together. That sounds weird when you say it like that. But, you know, those who are the children of Leah would be closer together, and then the children of Bilhah would get land near each other, and Zilpah and such like that. But we're not going to go through where they all end up at that particular time. I hope you guys aren't offended if I skim right across chapter 34 like that without reading all of that. Okay, chapter 35 is similar, but we've got to pay attention to one of the tribes that's not going to get to cast a lot and get a big chunk of land, and that's Levi. So it starts off in chapter 35, the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab. We hear that a lot here because that's where they are, the plains of Moab. They're over here getting ready to cross the Jordan and destroy Jericho and start inheriting, but we've got to wait till after the book of Deuteronomy to do that. But he says, command the children of Israel that they give to the Levites cities to dwell in from the inheritance of the possession. You shall also give the Levites common land. They'll have the cities to dwell in, their common land for all their cattle. So the Levites, of course, are not going to receive land, but they're going to receive, if you think the air quote thing, cities. These are not cities the way we think of cities in our modern times. You know, you think of downtown Cincinnati, which is a small city by some standards. It's not like going to London, Cairo, New York. These are, we would call them villages. And they're going to get a certain amount of territory around the village itself. Verse 4 says 1,000 cubits. Interestingly, verse 5 then says measure 2,000 cubits. Seemingly perhaps a contradiction, but and there's different interpretations put on why do you say 1,000, then you say 2,000. It seems to mean a total of 3,000 feet radius around the village. And one speculation is that the first 1,000 is like for some of their livestock and such, and then another 1,000 where they can have gardens and orchards. So the Levites are not going to have crop land. They're not going to get to plant acres and acres of wheat and rye and barley, but they can have a vegetable garden and they can have fruit trees and such. But they're not to make a living by farming the land. How are they going to survive if they can't farm the land? What do they live on? Okay, yeah, they live on the tithes of the people. They have to trust God and to some degree have to trust that the people will obey God and provide the tithes. And there's a mixed record of that throughout Israel's history. And sadly, the record is leaning more towards people not paying their tithes properly than when they are. But it's not something that's detailed very thoroughly as you go through Kings and Chronicles when people are or aren't. But the Levites are going to get these cities scattered all throughout Israel, a total of 48 of them. So God's going to make sure they do that. 48 cities with the land around them. And of those 48, oh, before I move on, I want to mention, if you tally up the amount of acreage they're supposed to get, you know, 3,000 cubit radius, it comes out to the Levites getting a total of 36,000 acres, approximately. 36,000, when I first hear that, it's like, wow, that's a lot of land. But that's 36,000 out of approximately 5 million acres to go to the nation as a whole. So the Levites are getting a small percentage of the land, very small, of course, because they're not going to work the land for a living. They're going to live off the tithes. Okay, verse 9, God introduces a subsection within this. Lord spoke to Moses, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, you shall appoint cities to be cities of refuge for you, that the manslayer who kills any person accidentally may flee." Verse 13, it mentions there'll be six cities of refuge. So out of the 48, six of them have a special status. And as it turns out, three would be on one side, on the east side of the Jordan, three more on the west side. Okay, yeah. I got to turn and face it so I can see which way is east and west. And if I remember correctly, well, I'm remembering back a couple of years, I sat in some of the classes. I think Mr. Myers, in the book of Joshua and Judges, spends a fair bit of time talking about what cities of refuge were. So I'm not going to spend as much time as I might, but we'll do a brief review of what they are. They're places of asylum where a person goes if they kill someone accidentally. Now, we could add a person who kills someone on purpose might also go to a city of refuge, thinking, I don't want to get killed, but God will make a distinction between killing someone accidentally and murdering someone, which is done on purpose. And we see a term arise, in verse 19, the avenger of blood. Sometimes it's called revenger of blood. It's not the kind of avengers that they make movies about these days. So that avenger of blood is from the Hebrew Goel Hadam, G-O-E-L-H-A-D-D-A-M, which means redeemer of blood. So the redeemer of blood is a close kinsman and supposedly the nearest male relative. And this seems to be based on an ancient practice that goes back well before Israel became a nation. So assume there's this practice that someone kills a member of my family. If I'm the closest relative, I'm supposed to go kill the person who killed him. Now, what's the danger of what could happen next in a state case like that? Say, Craig kills my sister. I'm going to go kill Craig. What's Craig's brother Kurt liable to decide to do? Okay, Kurt kills me. Maybe my uncle says, I'm going to come looking for Kurt. Do you see how a bad development could proceed? And, of course, I'm not about to kill Craig or him, me, or anything like that. So what I want to make the point is this practice seemed to exist, and God imposed law and order on top of it. So he interjects government. And one of the things he says is you go to the city of refuge. It's a place where not just you go and you're safe, but you're going to go and there is going to be a trial. The judges will determine, did you kill by accident? Like, you know, I was starting my lawnmower and the handle flew off or the blade broke and went flying out and killed the guy. It was a complete accident. The judges would hold a trial, get testimony, whatever, and say, yeah, it was an accident. Or did I break off a blade of my lawnmower, waited around the corner for him to come and, you know, let him have it? No, that's not an accident. If they determine it was an accident, they use the term you lied in wait, you're guilty of murder. They turn you over to the revenger of blood. Okay, now we know this, right? So, if it turns out that you killed someone by accident, do you get off completely free? Is there still a punishment? Nate has his hand up.
Didn't they have to wait until the leader died?
Wait where?
In the city of refuge.
Okay, you went to the city of refuge. There's a trial there. If it turns out you're guilty of manslaughter, accidental killing, but not murder, okay, you're not going to be killed by the revenger of blood, but yeah, you have to stay there in the city of refuge. You're not allowed to go back home. If you leave the city of refuge and that revenger of blood finds you and kills you, sorry, you were supposed to stay there. He's not going to be guilty of anything. How long do you have to stay there? Till the death of the leader? Actually, more specifically, the death of the high priest. So I want to make the point that, okay, there's a punishment for killing someone accidentally. Not a steep a punishment. Why would you have a punishment for doing it accidentally? Will that accomplish something? Now, maybe I should clarify. If I know there will be a punishment if I accidentally kill somebody, might I act differently before I take steps that would accidentally kill someone? You know, I'm going to be encouraged to be a lot more careful. Even if I didn't mean to kill someone, it could ruin my life. So I got to be careful. I'm going to take steps to prevent accidental death. You know, and later on in Deuteronomy, we'll see if I have a flat-topped roof where people might go out and enjoy the sunshine, I got to put a railing around it. If I'm mopping the floor, I get a goofy-looking yellow sign and stick out there that says, warning, wet floor, you could slip and bust your head open. Yeah, take precautions to stop people from accidentally dying if you can. So I think it's worth noting that. Now, how long are you likely to have to stay in the city of refuge? And this is partly guessing, but possibly. It depends on how old the high priest is, right? Now, just think, how do you become high priest? You're the oldest son of the current high priest. So, you know, just think, the high priest lives a long, healthy life. He dies. Okay, I'm his son. I move into the office, what, when I'm 22, 23? No, if he lived to be 85, I might be 68 by the time I get to be high priest. And my son might be in his upper 40s, and he's not going to take over for another 15, 20 years. My point is, if you don't start being a high priest till you're fairly old, you might only be high priest 15, 20 years before you die. So the thought is that this punishment wasn't meant to be all your life you're stuck in the city of refuge. It's sort of, well, I don't know if we've had good examples lately. If you keep track of, you know, if you look at the Catholic Church, they tend to appoint someone as pope who's not a young man. And so it's fairly common, you get a pope, and he might be pope 5 or 10 years, and he dies, and they get a new one, and he's an old guy. And I see the high priest as perhaps being like that. But it's a perhaps, you know, things could turn around. You could have somebody who's a high priest. Aaron was high priest for 38 years, almost. So it could go that way. I'm getting off into speculation more than I need to, and I've got to get to the end of this book. But there's another important factor near the end in verse 29. Okay, while we're talking about this trial and deciding if someone's guilty of murder or of manslaughter, verse 29, these things shall be a statute of judgment throughout your generation and your dwellings. Whoever kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death on the testimony of witnesses, in the plural. One witness is not sufficient testimony against a person for the death penalty. Okay, so it takes at least two witnesses. Important factor. You know, so it's not his word against her word or his word against his word. You got to have at least two and preferably more. Okay, and there's some other interesting principles that come up with the rest of the chapter emphasizing personal accountability and paying the price. That you shall take no ransom for the life of a murderer who's guilty of death. He shall surely be put to death. What's a ransom in this case? Money. Okay, in this earlier scenario, I can't remember if Craig killed me or I killed him. But I kill Craig and I'm rich. I'm money bags. We have this trial. I say, hey, I know I get the death penalty, but how about if I slip you a couple million? No, okay, you can go. God says, uh-uh, no way. Money has no effect on this. You don't pay to get out of this. You do the crime, you do the time. Yes, Sky?
So is the ransom like what we have now for bail?
I don't think so. I think it's more referring to paying to get out of doing the punishment at all. Bail is money you put up saying, I'm going to go free, but I'm going to show up for the trial. And then supposedly, once you do, the bail money's returned. It's supposed to be, at least a portion of it. It's like putting down a deposit, you know. Okay, so the same applies. Say you're not guilty of murder, but you have to stay in the city of refuge till the high priest dies. Verse 32, you shall take no ransom for him who has fled to the city of refuge, so that he may return to dwell in the land before the death of the high priest. No, you can't do that. You can't say, ah, the high priest isn't that old. I might be here for years. How about if I just write a big check? Nope. You know, money does not pay the price. You have to pay the price. So God didn't have flexibility when it comes to that. And he didn't leave room for the judges to determine that either. In verse 33, you shall not pollute the land where you are, for blood defiles the land. And no atonement can be made for the land, for the blood that shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it. In other words, yeah, money is not the same. If someone's guilty of murder, he's got to pay the price. Therefore you shall not defile the land in which you inhabit, in the midst of which I dwell, for I, the Eternal, dwell among the children of Israel. He makes statements like that every now and then, showing these aren't just arbitrary rules. This is a statement of who and what I am. God is a God of justice. And you could even apply this towards that question of why did Jesus Christ have to die for sins? Why doesn't God just write them off? Okay, there is a penalty that has to be paid, or God is not a God of justice. He did allow Christ to pay for us. And part of my thinking that might be, and it's my own idea, is that partly he's the one that created us, and so he could take responsibility for his creation. Even if that's not true, though, it cost a life. And we say Christ's life was more valuable than ours, but he is our creator and lived a perfect life. So God wouldn't accept, you know, you couldn't write a big enough check, you know, instead. Justice has to be done. Okay, that's about all I had. I know Mr. Myers, I think, talked more about the cities and maintaining the roads so you can get to them. And I agree with all of those things that he taught you. It doesn't quite mention the roads here, but I think it does later in Joshua. My memory's a little fuzzy. I didn't go double check on that. The cities of refuge were to be evenly distributed, so no one is too far from one. So this supposedly justice is available to people. It's not, well, if I live down here near Gaza, I've got to go all the way up to, you know, Dan to get to a city of refuge. No, they're evenly distributed, and any one of them is a place where justice can be done. Okay, so to move on. Very anticlimactically, we'll reach the end of the book in chapter 36. And I say anticlimactically because it's kind of curious. Maybe it's because, you know, we're going to go from Numbers right into Deuteronomy and there's no big gap, so we don't have to have some satisfying conclusion to Numbers. The story carries on. We have an interesting thing, though. The chief fathers of the families of the children of Gilead, son of Machir, son of Manasseh, son of Joseph. So the leaders of Manasseh come to Moses, and they say, you remember back in Numbers 27, which they probably didn't call it Numbers 27, but they said, you know when those daughters of Zelophehad came and said, hey, our dad died without any sons, how about letting us, his daughters, have his inheritance? And Moses went to talk to God, and God said, yeah, that's a good idea. You know, the land, you know, if he doesn't have any sons, it'll go to the daughters. If he doesn't have any daughters, it'll go to his brothers, and so on from there. Well, these guys figured something out. They come to him and say, verse 3, now if they're married to any of the sons of other tribes of the children of Israel, their inheritance will be taken from the inheritance of our fathers. You know, especially when the Jubilee year comes. Remember the Jubilee, once every 50 years, everyone gets their land back. That's described in Leviticus chapter 25. Well, if the inheritance is counted through the male side of the family, these daughters, you know, basically take this land that they inherit. They're Manassites. They marry someone from Asher. Then when the land goes back, suddenly Asher gets that land as part of Asher. Let's see, where's... So Manasseh's Manasseh is around. There's Ephraim. I'm looking for where it's written on the map. Oh, well, we got half Manasseh over here and the other half in here somewhere. But say, you know, well, let's say Issachar is easier. It's right here. These daughters marry someone from Issachar. Now we're taking land from Manasseh and we redraw the border so it belongs to Issachar. Part of me says, well, who cares? Well, I guess if you're a Manassite, you care. And actually, many of us probably are Manassites, so we'd better care. But they're concerned about this. What's going to happen? We don't want this land changing from one tribe to the other. It sort of shows that God did still take the tribes fairly seriously. Moses is going to give them an answer. In verse 5, Moses commanded the children of Israel according to the word of the Lord. So it doesn't say that he went and talked to God, but it's implied that he did. So Moses' answer comes from God. It's according to the word of the Lord. And he says, what the Lord commands concerning the daughters of Zelophehad, let them marry who they think best, but they got to marry within the family of their father's tribe. So you can marry whoever you want as long as it's a Manassite. That way the land won't change and go to another tribe. And this sort of works pretty well. It'll go on to say the daughters of Zelophehad did exactly that. They all got married, but they married people from the same tribe, and everybody lived happily ever after. Are there any principles we might learn from this that applies to us? Because we're not really worried about the Jubilee year and our inheritance going to someone else. I was thinking sort of in this area, say I live down on New Richmond by the river, and I married someone from Kentucky, which I did. And so what happens in the Jubilee year? Does New Richmond suddenly become part of Kentucky? You know, you could see people in Ohio might not be happy with that. But we're not concerned about that, really. There are some other things we could draw from this. I thought it's interesting that he says that in verse 6, that these daughters of Zelophehad, let them marry whom they please. Now, there's a restriction, but he's saying, you know, you can marry whom you want as long as it fits within a certain category. And I like that because it's giving the impression that they didn't all have arranged marriages. And doesn't forbid arranged marriages. That's the way it's been done through a lot of human history. But he also says, hey, you can choose who you like. That's kind of the way we do it today. Sometimes not with the most forethought and wisdom, but you don't have to have an arranged marriage. Now, I'd say today, God, you know, judging from what the Apostle Paul wrote, I might tell you, you can marry whoever you want, as long as they're in the church. That seems to be the way Paul wrote it. You know, so you get to make your own choice, but it's within a certain subset. Anyways, that's not, I don't know, not that big of a deal. I'm not sure that God is saying, take this and apply this to the church, but I like the idea of freedom being there. I'm glad I get to choose who I married. Well, I guess it was a mutual choice, because if I chose her and she didn't choose me back, we probably wouldn't have had the wedding. I'm meandering down here. In my notes, I've got, this wraps up the book. Like I said, somewhat anticlimactic, but we're going to move to Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is going to restate some parts of the law quite a bit, introduce some new ideas, and remind us of a lot of the narrative that we just went through. So that's why I do want to begin talking about the five W's of Deuteronomy, although the test we'll do next week will only be on the book of Numbers. Anybody have questions before I make that jump? Yes, Kayla? Okay, so having said that, let's talk about Deuteronomy. Who wrote Deuteronomy? This one's pretty easy. Well, as all through the Pentateuch, we've been saying we believe Moses was the author. And the book reads like it's the parting sermon of an aged leader, which is exactly what Moses was. He'd been with them a long time. He loved them, cared about them. Most of the people he was talking to were a good 40 years younger than him. So he was like a father or grandfather talking to the family before he's going to leave. Now, of course, modern biblical scholars will claim that Deuteronomy is a collection of documents, and they try to pin it to the time of King Joash, or no, Josiah. Sorry, I didn't look at my notes very well. Remember, Josiah did a number of reforms, and he was the last good king before Judah was conquered. You know, one of his sons was Zedekiah, the last king. So some people would believe that he or someone under his reign put together Deuteronomy to support what he was doing. Okay, I don't think that's true. Now, there's various reasons to debate that. Of course, we believe that God inspired the Bible, and it's all truth, not just something people put together to make to tell people to obey their laws. I'll mention, and this will come up a little bit later, some more recent scholarship looking at documents from Hittites, Canaanites, and some of the Babylonian or Mesopotamian cultures have found an interesting thing. They see evidence of a number of treaties that are called vassal treaties. Like, these people pledge allegiance to this leader, and they all tend to follow a certain format, which they see that format seemingly reflected in the book of Deuteronomy as well. And I'll point that out as we go. And the idea is that those kind of treaties they see at a certain time period, not before and not later, but that in that time period corresponds with when we believe Deuteronomy was actually written. So it could be pure coincidence, but this supports the idea that it was written by Moses at the time the children of Israel were getting ready to enter the promised land, not hundreds of years later by somebody working for King Josiah. Yes, Danny?
So you're saying it was just in the style of this vassal treaty?
Yeah, it had certain elements. And actually, I have those a little bit later when I go over the what. So I was going to delay there to describe that format. So let's just talk about when, because we're verging on that. Of course, if Deuteronomy records Moses' last messages before Israel enters the promised land, then we know where it is in their story. And at the beginning, early on, it says that he began his early oration here on the first day of the 11th month of the 40th year. So if they wandered 40 years, he's at the end of that 40th year, so he's about done. And it's believed that he finished in about 5 weeks. So Deuteronomy is not one long speech that Moses gave, but a collection of different ones over just about a month's time. There's two general dates that we look at. And depending on, and there's two schools of thought as when the Exodus happened, which would affect when the conquest of the Promised Land. You know, the later date says around 1250 BC. The earlier date is 200 years earlier, about 1450. If you remember that documentary that we saw at Mr. Dean's house on patterns of evidence about the Exodus, that all supports the earlier date. And more archaeological evidence is supporting the earlier dates. So I tend to lean there, but it's not that conclusive. And the truth is, it doesn't matter. Where this falls in the narrative is very clear, even if we can't pin it to a date in the overall calendar. You know, this is at the conclusion of the 40 years wandering and just before entering the Promised Land. So Moses had to write it during a relatively short period. It wasn't here and there over the course of 40 years like we think Numbers could possibly have been. You know, it's all right there. And that leads to the where being pretty easy. It says it's on the plains of Moab. That's marked on the map as right here. I'm sure I'm just pointing at looks like an indiscriminate spot. And if you're listening to a recording of this on the website, you go, what's he pointing at? You know, some colored map that you... But, you know, it's just to the north of the Dead Sea, east of the Jordan, and on the other side is Jericho, where they're going to go over and conquer. So they're like on the edge. Think of, you know, any of you guys ever run track and field? Think of Israel as like, okay, they're getting down in the blocks, you know? And the guy's holding the gun. Deuteronomy is kind of like that. They're ready, set. They're waiting for that pistol to sound so they can jump across the Jordan and go conquer the Canaanites. And so a lot of what we read in Deuteronomy, we want to see. Now, they're not that much on the edge, but it's close. We're going to go. It's finally going to happen. Okay, so moving on then to the what, since that was pretty easy. We'll start off with the name. Deuteronomy is derived from the Greek name that was in the Septuagint. There was Deuteronomian. And that name, basically, it means second law. Second law. But we want to be clear, this is not a second law, but it's a restatement of many parts of the law already given. So it's not a different one. Throw the old one out, we're done with that, now we're starting over. It's not that at all. It's a reminder. And so we do see some things here again that we saw earlier. Significantly, the Ten Commandments are described. Exodus 20 is the first place. Deuteronomy 5 is the second. That's another thing. That might be one of the first things my grandma had me memorize. Where are the Ten Commandments? Exodus 20, Deuteronomy 5. You know, I've been able to tell people that since I was 10 years old. Never was good at memorizing what they said, but I knew where they were. The Hebrew name, if you want that, is Sefer Hadabarim. And I might not be pronouncing that correctly. Sepher Hadabarim. Which means, these are the words. If you're open to Deuteronomy, coincidentally, if you look down, the very first words in the book are, these are the words. You know, the Hebrews tended to just name their books the first words that were in the book. More often, the Hebrew name, they just refer to it as words, which I really like that name. Let's turn to the book of words. And I don't know if any of you guys have seen The Little Mermaid, the Disney cartoon. One of my favorite songs in there is what was Sebastian is trying to get the prince to kiss the girl. But so he, remember, he gets the music, set the mood. He says, winds, percussion, words. Okay, you'll never hear that song or see that movie now without thinking of the book of Deuteronomy. Words. Okay, that's Deuteronomy. Okay, and what it is, we could say, the generation that had left Egypt, that marched through the Red Sea, except for those who were 20, you know, 19 or under, they're all gone. So you've got a lot of people who were born wandering around the wilderness, eating manna all their life. So Moses is recounting the story. How did we get here? What led to this? It reminds me, you know, when I decided I wanted to be a history teacher, I decided one of the reasons I loved studying history is because I wanted to know, how did things get this way? How did the world get to be the way it is? You know, Moses is kind of getting, let me get you together before you cross the river, kill off all those Canaanites. Let's understand how we got here. So he recites all that. Now, I mentioned the similarity to those what's called vassal treaties. I've got that as a hyphenated word. Vassal is V-A-S-S-A-L, you know, hyphen treaties. Let me give you the six parts that were commonly in those treaties, and you might notice, oh yeah, I know that's in Deuteronomy. Number one is usually a preamble, which introduces the author. So basically a little bit of a talk. I'm Moses, let me tell you about what's been going on. Then number two, a historical prologue, or you could say a historical account. Now, what happened? Well, we came out of Egypt, we went to Mount Sinai, and then number three is, you could say rules, which is the short, easy way. The long word that scholars use is stipulations. Stipulations. And in a treaty would have stipulations. Like if I'm making a treaty with Julie that we're going to trade shoes every other week. So next week she's going to give me those nice blue shoes and I'm going to bring in my cowboy boots and give them to her. It would list exactly, I don't know who would do something crazy like that because I could never wear her shoes. But a treaty has specific terms or stipulations, or in this case, rules. Okay, and that's a lot of what's in Deuteronomy. Yes, I'm sorry. Sky? Number one was a preamble, which opening comments, specifically introducing the author. Okay, then the historical prologue, the stipulations. Number four, and this usually comes near the end, is orders for preserving the treaty and or displaying it. And we'll note later in Deuteronomy where God says, write this down, keep a copy here, you got to make copies, and the king's got to make his own copy. So there are orders about how to keep this book of the law. One thing, you could debate how well this is shows up in Deuteronomy. Number five is a list of witnesses, people who are attesting to this. But then number six, and you could say this is based on either obedience or disobedience, and the scholars call it blessings and cursings. So everybody obeys the stipulations, here are the benefits. You disobey, here's the punishment. And hopefully you've already memorized Deuteronomy 28 is blessings and cursings. So as I said, seeing these elements in a lot of treaties between rulers and their people at that time, some people said, hey, maybe Moses was borrowing that format when he put down the book of Deuteronomy. We don't have any hard evidence that that's the case. It could just be a mere coincidence. You know, you could argue, oh, maybe they borrowed from the book of Deuteronomy to make their treaties. The question about that is, how did they get access to it? It's not like the Israelites were sending it around as an email attachment to everyone. But, you know, we don't know. Let me add one other thing that we could put in the what, and I'll point this out as we go after I answer Michelle's question. Number four was orders for preserving and or displaying the treaty. So, hey, we got this written down. You got to preserve it. Put a copy in a safety deposit box, but also put one back on the message board where everybody can see it. And by the way, Deuteronomy doesn't say either of those things. That was a hypothetical. Okay, some scholars have noticed a pattern within the book of Deuteronomy where they think that much of where Moses is describing laws, what he's doing is explaining and expanding on the Ten Commandments. Because we'll build up to, quickly in chapter 5, a listing of the Ten Commandments. And then later some will say, okay, what he goes through chapter 6 through 8 is explaining how to have no other gods before the Lord your God. And then some things about not taking his name in vain. So that holds up pretty clearly in the case of some of them and less clearly in the others. But as I said, I've got in my notes to point it out to you where people think it might be following that. And if so, it's kind of a neat pattern because there are some things you say, okay, we got to keep the Sabbath. How do we do that? Well, one thing we do is we come to this class and we make a circle and we all discuss it, you know, how we're going to do it. But that's not the most effective answer in something like that. Okay, I've got another W yet. Why? Okay, one is Deuteronomy, we'd say, is a reminder of the law. Again, and for some people, that you know, they've heard it here and there, but they didn't get it all together at once, like the people standing at Mount Sinai shaking in their shoes. So there's a reminder with a strong encouragement to obey. Matter of fact, I've got written down, if you want to say what the theme of Deuteronomy is, I like to say the theme is remember and obey. You do see those words come up a lot. Remember and obey. God wants us to do that. Boy, I'm running out of time. I thought I was going to get through chapter 1, but I'm going to get through the five W's. Another way of looking at it is why some people look at this and they consider this to be emphasizing the heart and feeling of the law. So we've got the law, but this is putting some heart into it. And we could say it's summarized as God's love. Ooh. Guys, give me a minute and I'll wrap this up. Because God's love comes through and he shows he wants his people to love him. And many Jews and Hebrews considered the heart of the book, at least, or the start of it, to be Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 and 5. Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 and 5 is commonly called the Shema. Just like Deuteronomy was called words, because the first word in Deuteronomy 4 is hear or listen. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your might. That should sound familiar. First and greatest commandment. Notice, the heart of the law is love. God loves us. He wants us to love him. Okay, and let me mention, and I'm not going to read all this, but Deuteronomy 10, verses 12 through 13 could be considered an expansion. Matter of fact, I'll read it because I've got it printed out here. That was Deuteronomy 10, verses 12 through 13. What does the Lord ask of you but to fear the Lord your God, walk in his ways, love him, serve the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul, to observe the Lord's commandments and decrees that I am giving you, comma, for your good. Actually, it says for your own good. I think the old King James left out own. But that's one thing I'll emphasize as we come to it, and that's one thing I appreciate Frank McCready, who I've worked with at camp and has taught classes here, over and over again, he would go to that scripture and say, why does God want us to obey his law? For our good, because we're going to benefit from it. Not just because he likes bossing us around. And in that aspect, we see here that a major aspect of God's law is grace. The law includes grace. It's not grace or the law. Grace is an aspect of the law. And hopefully that comes out, you know, if we look at these things honestly. And honestly, we're out of time. So I'll stop there. We'll do the test on Wednesday. So then next Thursday, we'll start working our way through the book.